Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Ben Mezrich. I first stumbled across Ben's work when I came across the title Bitcoin Billionaires, and what a catchy title, but really what a gripping nonfiction work. And it was about the Winklevoss twins and their rise through the Bitcoin world and their rise through all of what happened with them with Facebook. And so it was a really interesting account, and it was told in such a way that made me want to keep reading. And we talk about that in this episode. Ben Mezrich is also the writer who wrote the books for the movies that became 21, a movie about a bunch of college kids who took over Las Vegas, and The Social Network, which was a very widely acclaimed movie about Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, and the Winklevoss twins were in there as well. But here in this conversation, we talked a little bit about those, but we also talked about The Anti-Social Network, and that's Ben's latest book. I can't believe that he got a book out this soon. This is a topic that just occurred in January of 2021, and he already has a book about it out in September of 2021. He's clearly a fast writer, and he's an incredible writer. So in this conversation, we went deep on his process, and we went deep on him as a writer. He's written 23 books, pretty incredible. And so he's got a lot of wisdom. So if you enjoyed this episode, let me know on Twitter, at @HeyDannyMiranda. And please share it with someone you think would benefit from this episode. But now, without further ado, let's get into my conversation and interview with Ben Mezrich.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Ben Mezrich, it is such a pleasure to have you here. I'm really honored. I really am a huge fan of your writing and the way you're able to tell stories. So thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. And it's nice of you to say. I'm happy to be here.
So I've been seeing you do all these interviews lately. What's that like, doing all these interviews to promote a new book? Tell me about that experience.
I've been through this a bunch of times now. This is, I think, my 23rd book, which is kind of amazing.
Wow.
But, every tour is different. Obviously, the pandemic and what's going on in the world right now has totally made this one very unique. A lot of it is just from my bunker where I'm just talking out to the world through Zoom or podcasts and stuff. Every time you come out with a book, it's exciting and terrifying, and you never know how it's going to be received, and you hope you get a lot of attention, and then you do what you do. But I'll say that the podcast thing has changed book tours dramatically, as you can imagine. I remember when a book came out, you would just do radio, right? Radio, because you do a little TV, but most of your talking was on radio, and it was all in like 2-minute clips, right? Now with the podcast format, obviously you can go more in depth to things, and you get to talk a lot more. So it's a completely different animal. But when I write a book, I can't wait to get people to reach people with it, and it's always just a battle of beating. There's so much news, there's so much noise. And especially now, I mean, it's crazy. You can't even open up a newspaper anymore. So I'm happy to talk about it and have someone actually listen.
Of course. Yeah, well, it's so crazy because I saw this book come out and then I see what it's about. And I'm like, it's about GameStop. And how did you write it so quickly? This just happened.
And it did happen, yeah.
And now you're publishing an entire book on it. Books sometimes take people years to publish, to write, to edit everything. And you managed to turn this around like it was an article or a long feature. So how did you manage to take such a subject that there's so much to, right, and be able to turn around so quickly?
Well, I mean, it was nuts. I was watching it happen just like everyone else. I've always been interested in stocks, and I'm sort of a gambler by nature. And so I was watching the GameStop craziness, and as the stock ran in January to almost $500, a share. And I started getting tweets and emails and people were like, oh, you should be writing about this. And I dove in. I mean, I really just went in, you know, head first and started calling everyone I could reach and reaching as many sources as I could and just writing. And the truth is I write very quickly. I'm not like the 3-year book kind of guy. I'm the 3-month book kind of guy. So I've always written fast. I think Bringing Down the House, which about the MIT Blackjack team, I wrote that book in like 8 weeks. And the Social Network book I wrote in about 11 weeks. So it's not like I normally take that long to write. The more interesting part to me was how quickly could a publisher get a book out? You know, how could you have a massive book launch in 6 months as opposed to what normally it's a year minimum from when you hand in the book, or 9 months. You hand in the book and 9 months later it comes out. This one, the book didn't even exist in January. The idea of it didn't exist in January. The story didn't even happen. And we've got, you know, a book launch now and a movie on the way. And it's just amazing how it all came together.
Yeah, I like to say that your biggest passion in 10 years hasn't been created yet. And this is a perfect example of that, because the world is moving so quickly and in such a fast way. So take me through the way you interview people and the way you extract information from people. The dialogues that you provide in the book, you say some are created and some are fictional, but they're mostly true. And so I'm curious how you extract these stories from people, because I'm trying to do the same thing with this podcast.
Yeah. Well, I'm not like the journalist who comes in with a recorder or a notebook and is like that. I'm not a New York Times writer. I'm not a newspaper writer. I don't even really call myself a journalist. I'm more of the guy who meets you at a bar at 2 a.m. and you tell your story to, and then I find a way to tell that story. And so I approach my sources that way. I mean, I reach out to everyone I can who's involved in the story, and I say, hey, I want to hang out with you. Tell me about this, or how did this happen? And because of the movies I've made, I have access. People usually want to talk to me, or they don't want to talk to me. It's a mix of people. Some people definitely do not want to talk to me, and other people are like, yeah, I want to tell you my story. And what I do with my books is I try and create it or recreate what I've been told in a thriller, dramatic fashion. So it's not a normal journalistic take on something that happened, but more of a narrative nonfiction take. And there are definitely critics out there who do not like the way I write, who think that what I'm doing should be considered fiction, or you know, there's no quotation marks for the most part. I have dialogue, but you don't know, you know, it's the gist of what was said in that situation. And so the facts are true, and as much as I can, the sentiment of everything that happens is true. And I'm recreating dialogue as people told it to me, because you can't go back a year ago and listen. You know, I wasn't in the room when it actually happened. But yeah, I mean, my process is really to be a part of the story as much as I can. The pandemic made that difficult. So in previous books, I really would just go and hang out with the people for 6 months or 3 months or whatever it was. Live with the Winklevi twins, you know, follow them around New York for a while. But for this project, it was much more Zoom, just like, you know, similar to what you do, I guess, is you get people and just to get them talking as much as they can. And I think the key is to not be confrontational, to try and, you know, even the people that you know you are not going to love necessarily what's written about them, you have to find a way in that makes them feel confident that at least they're going to get some of their side told in a fair manner. So you're trying to be fair and you're trying to tell the truth, and that's all the best you can do. But, you know, in the end, my goal is to entertain my audience, and hopefully with this book, that's what I've done.
Yeah, it's certainly an entertaining read. Do you record these conversations, or you just let it go and let it be and then jot notes? How do you actually approach that?
You know, I've done it every different way, but actually, normally I don't record it. Normally I sit and I type as I talk. So I'm basically just writing down everything that's said to me. Other things are like I email questions to people. A lot of the more lawyered up type of characters that you're talking to would rather have you email them questions so they can write questions back to you. I'm willing to do it anyway. I mean, I did one book where this guy, I wrote a book called Sex on the Moon about a kid who had robbed NASA. It's a really great story. True story about a guy who was on his way to being an astronaut. And then one night he broke into a secret lab and stole moon rocks that had been to the moon. And it's a crazy story. But he would actually just at night record himself. So he spent hours just sitting there by himself because it was easier than me asking him questions. He just wanted to tell stories to me. And then I would download all of these things. So there's a variety of ways that I think once you get people talking, you know, as you know, it's great. I mean, if they're telling you stories, it's better than me picking at them and trying to get the story out of them. So I really love sources that are just storytellers. But in the end, you know, it's different for every character. And often it starts with emailed questions, and then there's a phone call at some point, and then there's a meeting in real life or a Zoom call or something like that.
You mentioned the Winklevoss twins, and that was an incredible book. I was so hooked and grasped by that, the book on Bitcoin billionaires, and I'm like, this is amazing. Tell me what the most surprising thing that you learned from living or working closely with.
I wasn't like the third Winklevi living.
What did you learn?
The twins are amazing. I really am in awe of them. They're larger than life characters, as you can see. But even even in real life, separate from how they look, they really are impressive people. I mean, they're guys who are so driven, so ambitious. They're really building an empire, and they have a lot of foresight, and they really stick to the idea that things take time. They don't have a problem with looking at windows in decades, you know, which is a very unusual trait, I think, for most people, because most people are trying to get as much as they can out of something right now. And the twins definitely take the long view, which is really interesting because they're in Bitcoin, which is something that hasn't taken the long view very often. It's usually everyone's that day. What is Bitcoin doing today? No one looks at it in 10-year windows, and it's such a dramatic change. What Bitcoin's done in 10 years or whatever is spectacular. But when you look at it from moment to moment, you know, it doesn't look like that. So it was fascinating. I learned a lot about, you know, I didn't know anything about crypto, Bitcoin, you know, that whole world. And now I'm somewhat of an expert simply because of the Winklevoss twins. And they taught me a lot about that. And so, it was a great experience. And I will say The Antisocial Network, the new book, is really a continuation. I mean, you can look at Accidental Billionaires, Facebook and the digital world and us going online. And then you go to Bitcoin, crypto, and this whole revolution in money. And then to this, which is meme stocks and Doge and the idea that value is no longer about fundamentals, but about the community. These are connected stories to me. So maybe one day they can box them up as a trilogy, even though it's, I think, three different publishers. But I do see it as a continuation of the story.
And I feel like the next chapter in that is something to do with NFTs.
I mean, I definitely am interested in NFTs. I'm thinking about doing something in NFTs, if not in writing, but in an advisory capacity or a business capacity, because I'm fascinated by it. I love it. I think that the idea that value is what we make of it. I've always been interested in art and the art world. I almost wrote a thriller once about modern art because it's just a spectacular idea that, you know, a canvas with a couple dots on it can be worth $100 million because we agree it's worth $100 million. How is that different than an NFT, which is unique and original? So I get it. And I have kids, and so they're young and they're like little kids. And to them, the virtual world is just as real as the regular world. They play Fortnite and Roblox. And to them, buying clothes for their Fortnite character is just as good as buying an actual toy. If I give them $20, they're more than likely to spend it on something online that doesn't really exist than to spend it on something physical. So to the younger generation, and you're young, to young people, it makes complete sense. And there's no reason why something digital and unique shouldn't be worth a lot of money if it's valuable to you, just as valuable as anything in the physical world. So I love it. I think it's fascinating. And I don't know if there's a book in NFTs like that. For me, the book part of it, there needs to be characters, drama, conflict. There has to be something crazy and like big money and exciting locales. It can't ever be people sitting and staring at their computer. And it's interesting because I wrote a book about Facebook and now I've written a book about GameStop. But I never want there to be scenes where people are just sitting and staring at their computer because that's boring and you can't really make a movie out of that. And so there needs – I wouldn't have written about Bitcoin without the Winklevoss twins. And I wouldn't have written about, you know, GameStop had there not been this drama between this guy in his basement, Keith Gill, right, and this giant hedge fund. Like, and that's what really turns me on about it. So for the NFT thing, I don't know what that drama is yet. I wouldn't just write a book about NFTs. That's more of a journalist's job. For me, there would have to be some thrilling, you know, through line, some sort of story to grasp onto.
It's so new, the world of NFTs, that it's like the story hasn't even been written yet.
Yeah, it's going to grow. It's going to really change a lot. I mean, it's a really revolutionary thing when you think about what they could be or how far they can go. I mean, the art is just one tiny component of it. And we'll see. But I'm definitely looking into it. There'll be more on this subject for me, I think, at some point.
What other components do you think that NFTs could go down?
I think it's community building, which is really intriguing. It's a way of building a community and giving access to people in a really specific way. And so with the antisocial network, what I've discovered is the power of a community is just immense. The fact that GameStop can go to $500 a share because a bunch of people on Reddit want it to go there, it moved markets. You know, it has nothing to do with the fundamentals. Who the hell knows what GameStop is actually worth? I mean, they may be worth nothing, right? But that doesn't matter. And I think that the power of that is just beginning, the power of social communities. And so NFTs is an interesting and sudden way of building a community around a shared interest or a shared ideal or a shared sentiment. And I think the power of that, it's who knows? Who knows where that goes?
Yeah, it's a really exciting new development that seems like it's come from the GameStop of the world. And you know, your writing is so compelling. It just makes me want to continue reading, and page after page. I'm sitting there last night reading the Antisocial Network and just find myself, oh my God, it's midnight and I'm still reading this book. So why do you think your writing is so compelling?
You know, I think I come at it from a movie point of view, a movie perspective. I grew up watching TV and movies, and that's really what I love. I just happen to write books. And so I write them in a manner that I think is very much made for a movie. I sit down, I sell the movie before I write the book. So almost always, I write a 10-page proposal. I sell it to a Hollywood studio. There's a screenwriter working on it while I'm working on the book. So I'm not just writing a book to be a book. I wouldn't even start a book if I didn't think that there was a movie behind it. And they don't all make it. They don't all get made, but they're all start in that way. So I think I approach every scene in the book as if it's a scene in a movie. How do you get into it? How do you get out of it? What's the action in it? Where's the, you know, and they all have arcs like a movie. My outlines are very much like a screenplay outline, you know, with three acts and all these different events happening in them. So I think it's the approach I take. My goal, I was a big Michael Crichton fan. I thought Michael Crichton was the best writer around. And he was very good at ending chapters in a way that you had to start the next chapter. And I try to do that as much as I can, that every chapter ends in like a cliffhanger or this moment that drives you to the next page. I don't ever want someone to be able to put the book down. But I also do want it to be a quick read. Like my goal was always, if you could read the book, you know, on the flight from New York to L.A., that's my ideal situation, because that's how I want people to read the book. So it's all quick and it's short chapters, and the goal is to keep you reading. Yeah.
With Bitcoin Billionaires, I finished it in 48 hours. I was like, this is one of the fastest books I've read all year. What's it like when you see your movie for the first time based on things you've written? How does that feel, that very first time?
It's a wild experience. 21, which was the movie about the MIT Blackjack team, I actually watched the movie for the first time in a empty theater sitting next to Lawrence Fishburne, who's in the movie. And it was like me and Lawrence Fishburne and a couple of the MIT kids. And it was the weirdest experience because it was my first big movie being made from one of my things. And it was just so cool. And I had watched them film it. So I'd been on set for the whole thing. The Social Network also, I was on set for most of it. And that script was just one of the best things I've ever read. Aaron Sorkin is amazing. And I remember reading the script and going, wow, this is going to win Oscars. And then when you see the movie, it's just really intense. It's just like, because you pictured it for so long. And I think the movie is very similar to the book, that one. And you spend a lot of time thinking of these scenes, and to see them through the lens of someone like David Fincher and Aaron Sorkin, I mean, what a dream. Like, as a writer, you can't ask for a better pairing than that. I'm not sure it will ever happen again to that degree with my career. But, I mean, I don't know who the director of The Antisocial Network is yet. The script is done, and it's gone out to directors, but I haven't seen, you know, heard who's, you know, but I'm sure it will be someone really exciting and big. But it's just amazing. There's such great filmmakers out there. And the acting, like The Social Network, you know, when we first were told it was going to be Justin Timberlake, you're like, really, Justin Timberlake? But he's really good. He was so good as Sean Parker. And Andrew Garfield was pretty much new. I mean, that I think was his first real movie, and he was amazing. And then, so it was just a great cast. Jesse Eisenberg is awesome. The casting on that was perfect. Jesse Eisenberg is more Mark Zuckerberg than Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg. So I loved it. I mean, I've been lucky, though. I've had two great movies, in my opinion, made out of my books. Most authors don't get that lucky, and usually something trash is made. And listen, I've written a lot of books. At some point, one of my books will get made into a trashy movie. It's just inevitable. You know it. You can't really control. You can control who you sell it to, but you can't control it after that point. After that point, the director has a lot of power, and the actors, depending on how big they are. And at that point, the author has no veto power of anything. So, you gotta sell it to the right people, and then just cross your fingers.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I'm not a big movie person, but 21 and The Social Network are two movies that I've actually seen.
Oh,
and,
cool. Yeah.
And so it's really interesting. What do you think, and a lot of people also, the phrase goes, you know, the book is always better than the movie. And your movies have turned out really well from the books you've written.
The Social Network is a close one. The Social Network is a really good movie. I don't know. I think that the book and the movie are one thing. I really think of them as not in competition. So my goal is you watch The Social Network and you love it, and then maybe you want to check out the book that it was made of and see what was different and what was there. 21 is interesting. I think Bringing Down the House was just a really big book. It sold a lot of copies. Every college kid and high school kid pretty much had that book. I would see it in people's houses. I'd be like, oh, there's that book. And so that book, I think, was beloved in a way that as a writer, you dream that happens. I don't think I've had another book that was like Bringing Down the House yet. Hopefully the Antisocial Network will be like that, where everyone just kind of wants the book. But yeah, I mean, they're different animals. You know, the movie is so much has to happen for a movie to get made. There's so many hoops it has to go through and so many steps it has to go through that it's not just you in a room writing. You know, with a book, it's you in a room, you write the book, you give it to your editor, maybe they do some edits, but that's pretty much it. With a movie, there's hundreds of people, and there's studio executives, and there's money, and there's so many things have to happen for it actually to get onto the screen, that, you know, somewhere in the process, it changes pretty dramatically. It's very unusual for a book and a movie to be all that similar. So, you know, we'll see what happens with The Antisocial Network. But you never know. Yeah.
What's the most overwhelming part about that whole process?
Of a book to a movie?
Yeah.
I mean, once the engine gets going, like once they're actually shooting, it's like a military operation. I mean, you're on set and there's just hundreds of people and they all know what they're doing. And you're just kind of wandering around like, I don't understand how any of this comes together. It's fun, you know, it's a lot of fun, but it's very nerve-wracking, intense, and like there's a lot of fear. You know, no one wants it to fail, and no one wants anything to fall apart. And then once it actually comes out, there's this massive marketing machine behind it, and everyone's kind of watching it and judging it, and like how much money does it make, or what do the critics say, and all this kind of stuff. And you have no control over any of that, so you have to just sit back and say, you know what, it's just fun. I'm having a good time, and that's all there is to it. It's overwhelming. Like the Oscars was wild. I mean, The Social Network ended up at the Oscars and we got to go, and my wife and I, you know, walking on the red carpet, and we end up at an after party at Madonna's after party. This was back in the day when Ashton Kutcher and Madonna like co-hosted an after party at Guy O'Siri's house. And I remember sitting there and like I was on a couch and I was holding the Oscar that Trent Reznor had won for the music for The Social Network. And next to me was Molly Ringwald on one side and Nicole Kidman and her husband. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. I'm like a writer from Boston and I shouldn't be here. It was hysterical. And like, you have so much fun. And the whole Oscar phenomenon is just out of this world, especially when you don't expect to be. I mean, you write a book about Facebook, you don't expect to end up at the Oscars. And so it was a great, wild experience. But the other thing is that, you know, Hollywood is, I stay here and they're there and I go out there and I have a great time. But my life is not that. My life is, you know, in Boston, or I'm up in Vermont now, writing, because that's what I love to do. I love telling stories. I like coming out and talking about the stories. And I'm involved in Hollywood. I'm actually a writer on the show Billions. I'm in the writer's room. I was for season 5 and one of the producers for season 5. So I like being involved, but I like being involved as the writer. You know, I like sort of telling the stories and then not having any responsibilities on the actual set. So, you know, it's wild. It's a wild career, but it's just crazy. You know, you never know what next year is going to be. which is, you know, all the entertainment fields are kind of like that, but it's not a field for someone who needs to know where you're going to be a year from now, because you have no idea where your career is going to take you each year.
How'd you get involved with Billions? That's pretty crazy to see your name as a on the screen in Billions. Yeah.
So I've been a fan of the show forever. It's one of the shows that I just love and I watch. And Brian Koppelman, who writes it, he wrote the movie Rounders. And when 21 came out, Rounders, they were around the same time and they were both kind of card movie. So we kind of knew of each other, but had never really met. And he actually, Bitcoin Billionaires had just come out. And he on Twitter found me and was like, you know, who's making this movie? I'm really interested in this. So he was interested in Bitcoin Billionaires for a little bit. And I talked to him. And as we were talking, he was like, you know, have you ever written for television before? And I was like, no, I sit in my room. I don't work with people. I've never. And he's like, well, come, I want you to be in the writer's room. Would you like to write an episode? Would you like to be a producer? And so I said, fine. So I came to New York like 4 days a week for, God, it had to have been 12 weeks or something like that in 2019, right up until the pandemic, basically. And I was one of the writers. I wrote episode 3 of season 5, and I was producer on all the episodes of the season. And it was just amazing. It's such a great writing team. Brian and David, who run the show, are just geniuses, and their style of dialogue is just off the charts amazing. And get to be on set, and it was really cool. And we had to stop the season halfway because of COVID, and now they're airing again. So they finished the second half, and they're working on season 6. But it was a great experience. I'd never written for television before. I'm really curious about it because TV is where a lot of great stories are being told. So I don't know. At some point, I'll be involved in TV more. But I just wanted to learn the process and see how it works from some of the best in the business. So that's how that came together.
What's the differences between writing a book and writing for TV?
Writing for TV is again, a group of people. So you sit in a writer's room with 6 other people, come up with storylines. And then when you write your episode, you're kind of on your own, but then you bring it in and then the whole group goes through it. And there's a lot of, and the people in control of the show can just change anything they want. So it's not, you know, it's not an individual kind of situation. Well, writing a book, you're the god of the situation. You write what you want, you sell it, and it goes. The difference also is on television, you know, you get pretty direct feedback because everyone's watching it and you can see what people think of it. And it's very, you know, interesting. The process of selling television, I think, is very difficult. Like actually getting a show on the air is just nearly impossible. There's so many hoops to go through. So if I were starting out today, I probably would not go into television, even though it's like the golden age of television, simply because it's just so hard. And the writing for TV is actually very time consuming and difficult. It's kind of a vagabond lifestyle because you move from show to show. Shows don't last that long. Even a successful show, like 3 seasons, is amazing, right? So you put your whole life into something, and then in 3 years, it's just done. While with a book, I feel like a book kind of lasts forever, you know? You write a book, and it's there, and it's still being read 10 years from now. I don't know. It's different. It's a very different form of writing. But I enjoy doing it, and I'm sure I'll do more of it.
You mentioned before that you have written 23 books. This is your 23rd book, which is crazy to say and to think about. Right. What advice would you have for yourself writing your first book?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to remember this was a very different time. So there wasn't such a thing as the internet. It's a really long time ago. So, you know, it was when I started out, the way you wrote or the way you made it, you wrote and you sent it out through the mail to publishers and just waited and got rejection and sent in rejection and sent in rejection. So it was a very different world of how to break in. And then when your book comes out, you know, you get lucky or you don't, whether people read it, and it's very hard to get any press. And I'm at a different point in my career now. I would say the key is to figure out what it is that you really should be writing. Like, what is your voice? When I started out, I was writing medical thrillers. I was writing sci-fi. I wrote for the X-Files. I wrote a book for them. I was trying to write like pop thrillers because that's what I like to read. I wanted to be Michael Crichton. And it wasn't until I stumbled into this Vegas story that happened to be a true story that I became a nonfiction writer. But that was never my goal. My goal was to write, you know, Michael Crichton, was to write Jurassic Park. I wanted to write Jurassic Park. So I think if I had to, there's not, I mean, I was lucky, you know, but I think I did the right thing. I really locked myself up and I wrote. When I wanted to, I was 20, I just graduated from college. I moved to an apartment in Boston and I wrote 24 hours a day and I wrote 9 novels in 1 year. So I literally wrote almost a novel a month for a year. I wrote something like, I'm trying to, it was you know, 100,000 words per novel. So I wrote almost a million words in 1 year, which is insane. By the end of the year, I kind of knew how to write. None of those books ever got published. They were all kind of garbage. But then I started writing better books because I had written, you know, the 10,000 hour thing. I mean, I had was way beyond that. And I think I don't recommend that. I don't say anybody should do that because it's nuts and you're just a disturbed individual. And I was drinking. Like it was not a great scene for anybody. But I honed my abilities. So I do think if you want to be a writer for a living, like this is your job, you have to look at it as this consuming, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to write every day. I'm not saying you should write what I wrote, but write a few pages every day. And you should think, always be thinking about what the next story is. Write a book and then move right on to the next book. Like, don't just sit, I wrote a book, I'm done. Because it just doesn't work that way. You just keep, go at it like you're the Terminator. You watch, you know how the Terminator absolutely will not stop until you're dead. Like, I would not stop until I sold a book. Like, that was my goal. I wrote, I got 190 rejection slips that first year. I got rejected 190 times before I sold my first book. And I used to tape them to the walls around me, so it was all rejection slips. And I was just like a lunatic because this was it. This was all I wanted to do. And I think in all the artistic fields, you know, you have to be that driven in what you're doing. If you're not driven, it's just impossible because there's a million people trying to do it. And someone is working harder than you, and it's like professional sports kind of, except for, you know, the good thing about it is you're sitting in a room by yourself, so it's all you. You're not, it's like acting. Actors have to go out into a room and get rejected to their face. You know, singers have to sing in front of people. Writers don't have to do that. You sit in your room and you write. You get rejected when you send it out, but at least it's all you. So the battle is really just with yourself. To get to the point where you're good enough that someone's going to buy something. I don't know. I mean, I don't recommend what my path necessarily, but it definitely, you need that intense level of drive to just break in.
What compelled you to keep going?
You know, this is all I ever wanted to do. Since I was 12 years old, this was it. And I graduated from college and my parents, you know, were not thrilled that I wanted to be a writer. My dad's a doctor. My mom is a lawyer. You know, they were like, you went to a good college. You should go get a job. I mean, do this on the side. And I was like, I don't want to do this on the side. This is just what I want to do. So they said, all right, we're going to give you 1 year. And if in 1 year you haven't made any real advancement in this career, we're going to basically cut you off. You're going to have to go do something. So they let me live for a year and took care of the rent and everything, which was amazing for them to do. And that's why I wrote Round the Clock. I was like, I got 1 year and I don't know what's going to happen after that. And so I literally applied to like law schools and deferred so that I had a backup, but I never intended to go. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote, and I managed to get an agent by the end of that year. And I sold my first book like 1 year after that or so. So I had to take jobs in the following year, but, I was really driven. It's like, it's just what I wanted to do. I just knew this was it for me. I couldn't see myself working in a regular job or it just wasn't, you know, I would have made more money in finance or whatever, but it just wasn't for me. So I'm desperation, I guess, or just the view that I really was going to do this for a living. And, you know, I don't want to say that then it was over because my first six books bombed. Nobody read them. And so it wasn't until my seventh book, Bringing Down the House, that I actually really could do this for a living. So, you know, it takes a while. Even an overnight success takes a lot of work in this business.
What was the first sign that you were really onto something?
Yeah, it was Bringing Down the House. It really was. Like my other books, no, let's be honest, I was vastly overpaid for them. So it wasn't like I was starving. I sold some thrillers and I had sold a TV movie and I was working for the X-Files. So I was actually on paper doing a lot of cool things, just nobody was reading the books. So they would just come out and sell like three copies to my parents, right? And then Bringing Down the House, so when I sold it for very little money. It wasn't a big book. It was going to have a tiny print run. I think the first print run was 12,000 copies. So it was not expected to be a successful book. And I got the Today Show. And I go on, and after the Today Show, that day the book like sold out everywhere. Amazon, number one on Amazon, froze. It was this crazy moment where the book was gone in one day. And at that moment, I was like, wow, something is happening here. And it was because it was such an easy sell. It was like one sentence, six MIT kids who took Vegas for millions. It was like the perfect sentence that every news report could end on. And every, like, oh, there's a story about these six MIT kids who took Vegas for millions. It's like everyone loves that. So it just sold and sold and sold. And it was on the bestseller list for like 60 something weeks. It was more than a year. And so at that moment, I knew I'd made it as an author. Then it's the question of where do you go from there? But I was never a guy who just writes a book. At that point, that was my seventh book. So I was writing pretty much a book a year forever from since then. I mean, so I never stopped. Now, the thing is, like I say about my career is I've hit two home runs and lots of singles and doubles. You keep trying to get that again. You know, how do I do that again? And the problem with nonfiction is your audience doesn't necessarily follow you from book to book. In fiction, if you have one huge book, the audience will come to your next book and your next book and your next book. But in fiction, in nonfiction, it's about the story. If I write a book about, you know, whatever next, people aren't necessarily going to read it if it's not something they're interested in. So it wasn't until The Social Network or Exit of Billionaires where I hit another home run. And there are some books in between that I really love. Like I wrote a book called Ugly Americans about expat traders living in Tokyo. It has a huge cult following. It's a really fun book about Japan and the craziness there. But it never took off. And I had another book, Straight Flush, about the online poker thing that was successful in its own community. So I've had books that have been successful, but not monster books. And then The Social Network was like a monster book. And so you never know when you're writing a book if it's going to be a home run or not. I don't know. I mean, in this career, you know, you can make it lots of times and still not be done. There's been moments where there have been enormous peaks. But it's one of those careers which just goes like that.
You raised such an interesting point about having the one-liner being the reason one of the reasons why it spread like wildfire. Did you start thinking in those terms of, am I going to have this one-liner? What is this one-liner for this book?
Yeah, absolutely. So I won't write a book if I don't think I can sell the book in like five words, basically. If I can't say, you know, it's the GameStop story or the story of a ragtag group of traders who took on Wall Street, you've got to have that sentence. And a lot of times people pitch me these stories that are very good stories, dramatic, and this crazy thing happened. And I'm like, I can't sell that. I mean, I try and go on a 2-minute CNBC spot and sell that book. It's not going to happen. It's got to be quick. It's got to be dramatic. It's got to be like, oh my God, I get it, you know, right away. Or people just won't. And it has to be international too. You have to think about the world now. And you know, my books sell in 20 countries. If it's not going to play in England or it's not going to play in France, it's going to be a hard sell for me. So it's a lot goes into deciding what I'm going to write at this point in my career that probably didn't before Bringing Down the House. It's got to be something that everyone is going to at least get, whether they love it or not. They're at least going to, you'll have a shot at doing it. I will say the Straight Flush book, like about online poker, had that problem. It's like, there are people who will really be interested in this, but there are a lot of people who would just say, I'm not interested in that. The Japan book too, Ugly Americans. Like there's a certain group of people, mostly men, who really wanted to read that book. And some of them even get tattoos from it and stuff. It's like a little crazy. Wow. But there's a lot of people in the Midwest who would have zero interest in learning about expat bankers in Tokyo. The Facebook book ended up being for everyone. And I didn't think it would. So when I wrote that book, I had no aspirations of this being like the biggest book, you know, The Social Network being a big movie. I remember my mom was like, no one's going to watch a movie about Facebook. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. They bought the rights. I think somebody's going to watch it. But she was kind of right. It's like, who would watch a movie about Facebook? But see, that's not what the story was about. It was about these two friends getting ripped apart. And it was about this revolutionary change in our lives and, you know, and about someone screwing somebody else over. Like, we all like that. And I think the Antisocial Network and GameStop is similar. Like, GameStop, you know, is one thing. But the idea that a group of regular people took on Wall Street, that's cool. You know, the David versus Goliath themes, they translate, you know, to every country. So it's coming out in a dozen countries, many of whom, you know, have nothing to do with Wall Street and GameStop, because it's this drama of regular people maybe winning just for once, you know, that's what you need. You need that one sentence, that theme that captures a big audience.
You mentioned before about how your career has been defined by home runs and a bunch of singles and doubles along the way. How do you not get too down or too up when you have a single, when you expected a home run or a home run? You know, how do you manage that balanced perspective?
I mean, it bothers you. It definitely, when you write a book that, like, I wrote a book called Woolly about this incredible scientist in Boston who is making a woolly mammoth in his lab. He's literally bringing back a woolly mammoth. And this is like Jurassic Park, but with real science, and it's real. And this guy, George Church, is a fascinating guy. This book should be enormous. And it came out, and it did well, but it wasn't like one of my crazy books. And we're working on the movie and everything, but it's disappointing when a book doesn't do what you think it could do. I never set out to hit a single or a double. I always want to hit a home run. And whenever I write a book, I think, okay, this is a story that I think is compelling to a lot of people. And you don't have a lot of control. I mean, the news cycle is so crazy. Like right now, it's just crazy. Like trying to compete with the pandemic and Afghanistan and whatever else is on the news today. Like getting on shows is hard. How do you get on a Today Show when, you know, there's wall-to-wall other coverage on something else? Selling a book is hard. And so you can't always reach people that you think would like the book if they actually just heard about it. So, you know, you have to try and not get frustrated. You have to think about the next project, the next project, and the next project. You can't just rest on one project. And when it happens, you should be happily and surprised because you just don't have a lot of control about, you know, whether it's going to be a monster or not. But if people read it and like it, I think that's what's really important. So.
We spoke about the importance of the one-liner when selling a book. What other tools and tactics have you gained from your many experiences selling your different books?
Yeah, I mean, you know, getting in front of as many people as you can obviously is important. It used to be you went from bookstore to bookstore and you just signed books and talked to people. That doesn't really move the needle anymore. I mean, people just don't go to bookstores anymore, which is fine. I get it, you know, especially during a pandemic. But even pre-pandemic, that wasn't really moving books anymore. Community. It's all about community. Word of mouth and like the Bitcoin story. Like Bitcoin Billionaires was kind of an easy sell because there's a built-in crypto community that wants to hear that story. And so once you reach that group, you know, they definitely are intrigued by it. So yeah, you do want to find some sort of community that has a reason to like the book, and has reasons to tell other people about the book. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it's tricky. It's really tricky to be thinking about how you're going to promote a book, because that's not really your job. And you have to hope and pray that there's a machine behind you that can make that happen. But the reality is you just don't have a lot of control over it. You have to write a book that you think is compelling that other people are going to really want to read. And beyond that, you know, you have to be able to talk about it, but you can't control much more than that. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't have a lot of advice on how you make a book a bestseller, because the honest truth is if I knew that, they'd all be bestsellers. I just know that, you know, each time you have to really take that shot and see if you can reach as many people as you can.
So take me through something you can control, which is your writing process. How do you sit down at the keyboard? Is it just, is there some natural thing that you do at this point? And
it's become natural, but it's, there's a lot. It's like the first thing I do is I write that synopsis. So it's like a 14-page book proposal as a treatment. I sell that in Hollywood usually, and then I sell it to a publishing house. Then I do the research. So basically I'm talking to everyone I can, interviewing everyone. There's lots of court documents usually in the books I write. Get a hold of as much of that as you can, newspaper articles, to the point where I've got stacks of just thousands of pages of stuff. Then I write the outline, and the outlines are very severe. For me, I know every chapter. I know the page numbers of every chapter. I'm really – and listen, I hate outlines. Everybody hates outlines. They're just horrible and boring. But the reality is they make the book so much better. And my outlines are very specific. Like I know all of the research is done, and I know what's happening in every single chapter. And that's when I start writing. So I don't start writing until all of the hard work is done and I can just write. And then it's a process of really locking yourself up. And I try and write, nowadays I'm between 6 and 10 pages a day. I used to write a lot.
How many words is that?
About 2,000 words a day maybe. I used to write a lot more than that, but that seems to be the appropriate amount, and you have a book in about 35 days. Of course, you don't walk around all weekends, and so it gets spread out. But that's really what I do. And once I've got all the hard work done, the writing comes much easier. It's like, you know, I'm writing, and you know what? One of the clues is don't write by time, write by page. So you say to yourself, I'm going to write 5 pages a day. If you're done in an hour, you're done in an hour. If it takes you 10 hours, it takes you 10 hours. And that motivates you to write faster and better, so that you don't, you know, spend 20 hours just staring at your computer. My day can be 4 hours long, or it can be 7 hours long, depending on how well the chapter goes. And I usually stop at the end of each day in the middle of a sentence. That's one of the little tricks for writers out there. Stop in the middle of the sentence, so when you sit down the next day, you just get going, because the hardest part is starting each day. I really just stop in the middle of a sentence usually. It's a difficult couple months, because you're really into the story, and the rest of your life just takes a hit. You know, you don't pay attention to anything else. You're just in that story. Try to eat the same meals every day. I become very weird while I'm writing. But then the book is done, and then, you know, you move on.
What other weird things do you do while you're writing or in that writing?
I have a lot of millions. I listen to music. I actually watch TV sometimes while I write, which is kind of interesting. But I'm usually trying to get my head out of my head, so I'm usually distracting myself while I write, which is interesting. I don't always write on a computer. I've done dictation. I've used dictation software for projects, written a couple chapters just lying down and talking. I have a little thing called the Alpha Smart. This thing is a really wild device. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these. They're really cheap as hell. They run on D-cell batteries. They're indestructible, and they can hold like 100,000 pages. And they last forever. There's nothing to them. It's a no frills, just one line of text. And you literally write on these things anywhere, and then you plug it into your computer, and it just spits the words out onto your computer. And so these were invented they airdropped them to kids in Africa because, like, people who didn't have internet and didn't have but wanted to write, they're really cheap and easy in there, and they don't need wireless or anything like that. But I found them to be a great wireless tool, because if you just want to write and no distraction, you just take this thing with you wherever you are and write on it. It's called Alpha Smart. They don't make them anymore, so you just got to buy them on, like, eBay or whatever. But so I've written chapters on this thing, you know, just lying in bed. You just write a quick chapter and just plug it into your computer. I don't know. I have lots of quirks. I used to play backgammon against myself every morning before I started writing, which is really weird. I'd play both sides of it. All sorts of little routines. It's all about routines and rituals to get yourself into the writing mode. I used to write at night. I used to be a nighttime writer, so I'd write from like 11 p.m. to 6, 7 in the morning. But now I got little kids, so I got to be awake to take them to school and stuff. So I've switched my writing to being more normal. So I usually write, you know, from like noon until like 5 or 6. So it's not a strenuous schedule by any means. But when I get into the depth of the book, then I'm writing round the clock. The last two weeks of the book writing, it's pretty much 24 hours a day.
And when you sit down at your keyboard, is there anything, a particular setup you have, water specific way, or how do you? I'm curious about all this stuff.
Not like the movie Misery, where you've got your cigar and your bottle of scotch. I used to drink, and so I used to have a bottle of Jack Daniels on the desk, and that was not a good scenario for anybody. But I gave that up, so I try not to drink anymore. But I did used to drink as I wrote. Back in my probably 20s and 30s, I was a drunk.
How do you give that up? Because that's, you know, you form a habit one way.
Yeah, so I guess... it was a birthday, and I was like, you know what? That's the last drink. And so I didn't drink at all for like 3 or 4 years. And now it's like, you know, every now and then I might have a beer or something like that, but I don't drink when I write. That's for sure. And it was definitely a fun time of my life, but I don't think, you know, it just physically was too demanding, you know. And I know a lot of writers just do still drink when they write, but I don't think it's not helpful. For some people it is helpful, but for me, I ended up writing my best work. Well, some of my good books I wrote drinking. So, you know, I don't know. It's a mix. Some of my books I've been drinking for, and some of them I haven't. And I don't know if you could tell which is which. I don't really drink. I have rituals in that I eat like the same meal every day. My time is very controlled and stuff like that. And I will sometimes like wake up at 3 a.m. and come and write until 6 a.m. or whatever. I do that a fair amount, when I'm writing a book. So yeah, it's crazy. I write on my phone a lot. I mean, you know, like on one of those little notepads, because sometimes you wake up and you're like, oh, that's great. And then you write a whole chapter that way. And then when you wake up in the morning, you have your chapter already done. I do that a lot. But yeah, I don't know.
I think it's awesome that you have so many different ways and you're open about sharing all those different ways, because
there's Yeah, I think it's tough trying to write a book and doing it the same way every day. You can do that for a couple weeks, but sometimes your brain just needs to find a different way to get something in there. And that's why I moved to the Alpha Smart or moved to the phone or something like that to start a couple pages. The hardest thing every day is starting. It's like the first, I mean, it's very easy. Writer's block is not sitting there staring at the page. Writer's block is like watching 20 hours of Saved by the Bell because you don't want to go work. And that's a hard thing to get out of when you just don't want to do it. But that's part of it, is picking a compelling story. If you're in a compelling, exciting story and you know people are waiting to read it, like the GameStop story, like I knew I was in a race to get this story to people. That really powers you a lot.
Was there ever a moment where you were like, I don't know about this writing thing, or has it been pure since you were 12 years old, not stopping, not a single moment of questioning?
You know, I never thought about doing anything else. There were definitely points in life where I was like, I got to make money. There were definitely, you know, points where you're like, geez, I was looking at business school applications, because I have friends, you know, I went to Harvard. Some of my friends went off to investment banks and were making fortunes in their 20s. And I was sitting there like eating peanut butter and jelly and trying to sell my next book. And I was like, I could just go work for a bank for 2 years and make a ton of money. And so, yeah, that thought occurs and still occurs to me today, because I have friends who are like billionaires. And I'm like, yeah, was it really the right choice? I mean, I could have gone and worked at, you know, Merrill Lynch, and right now it'd be worth a lot more money. So, you know, you think about it, but this is really it for me. Like, I knew that writing was going to be my thing. And I never wanted to be a screenwriter. Like, it wasn't move to LA and be a screenwriter. It was never going to move to New York and write television or something like that. It really was books. That was what I wanted to do. So, you know, it's worked out, and it's I've been very lucky that it's worked out the way it's worked out. But, you know, you definitely have those moments where you're like, you know, wouldn't it be nice to just not have to think about this stuff and just go work at McDonald's and, like, you know, do your order, make the food, give it to somebody, and then go home at night and watch TV. Like, you do slightly fantasize about that, because, like, for me, it's like, what's coming next? Where's my next story going to come from? Now I got to promote this book. It's like, you know, you have a lot on your shoulders all the time, but I do love being a writer.
It's really difficult to turn it off when you're working with the knowledge realms. What are the best ways you found to turn the brain off?
I mean, when I'm in the midst of a story, I don't. I mean, I'm really consumed by the story until the book is done. When you finish a book, it's nice to have a few weeks where you just do nothing, where it's like, for me, television, like, I love TV. I watch it all the time, which is funny because I don't really write TV that much, but I love watching just massive amounts of everything on Netflix, on Hulu, wherever it is. I think it's great. I love movies. You know, I read a lot. And I ski, I do tennis, I do all the stuff that one would do when one lives in Vermont, which is where I've been since the pandemic started. Normally I'm in Boston, so I'm more of a city person, but, you know, I don't know. You when you finish a book and you finish the book tour, there's kind of that moment where you're like, I'm done with that story. And it's hard to shift away from that story. Often I have another book coming out in the end of the winter, so I am going to be shifting pretty dramatically after this book tour. Right now, it's like I really just want to get this story out there, because I just think this is a really wild story. I think that people will really, you know, find something in. So I'm hoping, you know, the next 2 months, I'm just talking Antisocial Network nonstop.
The Antisocial Network, available everywhere.
Everywhere.
This is a great conversation, Ben. I've learned so much about creativity and writing and the way you think. It's been a real pleasure. Any final pieces of closing words?
I do a lot of podcasts. I tell you, you're great. I think this is a really good podcast. I enjoy it. I know I talk a lot, but it's fun to sort of talk to someone who's listening. So this is really good. And I hope lots of people run out and buy the book, and I hope I get to go on the tour at some point and sign them for people and go to bookstores and do that when this pandemic ends. If it ever ends, but at least when I've got 15 vaccines in my arm and I'm no longer entirely human, then I can get out there and sell the book.
Yeah, well, we'll put the book below so people can grab it. Really enjoyed it myself, and I hope people do as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
hope you enjoyed that episode with Ben Mezrich. Just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening until this moment of the podcast, 55 minutes in. It means the absolute world. And if you got to this point, maybe you enjoyed it as well. And if you did, shoot it over to a friend, text it, send it via DM, and share this episode far and wide if you can to a writer or someone you think would gain value from the insights in this episode. That's all for me. I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.